Genesis is the Greek form of the Hebrew word bereshit, which simply means in the beginning. This first book of the Bible is an account of the creation of the world, the early history of humanity, and in particular the origins of Israel's ancestors. In Genesis, we find the Jewish nation began with one man, one woman, and one God: Abraham, Sarah, and Yahweh. And from the beginning of the stories, Abraham's journey to greatness, like many other biblical characters, is saturated with both wisdom and folly, with strength and weakness, with praise and condemnation, all intentionally presented not as exact history, but as cautionary tales and lessons for the descendants of Abraham as they navigate what it means to be the covenant people, the children of God. In one such story found in Genesis 18:20, God reveals to Abraham that Sodom and Gomorrah are to be destroyed because of their grave sins. Abraham pleads for the lives of any righteous people living there, especially the life of his nephew Lot and his family. At first, God agrees to spare the cities if 50 righteous people can be found. And as the negotiations proceed, eventually God agrees to spare Sodom and Gomorrah if 10 righteous people can be found. Obviously, there were not 50 righteous people. There were not 40, there were not 30 or 20. Although righteousness is never defined, which is a bit of an odd thing because life and death are on the line here. In Abraham's time, there was no codified law, such as the Ten Commandments. So to be judged as righteous referred more to morally good than any sort of religious definition. One final observation about these life and death negotiations, which I find fascinating, the whole idea that you'd have this discussion with God and you'd kind of barter for the lives of humans. And, well, what about this? What about that? What if we do that? What about how babies are evaluated? I've never got an answer to that one. Do they get a chance to grow up to prove themselves to be righteous or unrighteous? Are they all going to be executed for the sins of their parents? Or for the potential that they may be unrighteous themselves later on? Or even the likelihood that they will be, since almost everybody is? Anyway, I don't have an answer for that one, but continuing with the story, two angels appearing as men are sent to Lot in order to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. But they're met with a wicked mob who ask for the newcomers to be brought out to them so that they can assault them. Lot obviously can't send two angels out to be raped, so he offers the mob his two virgin daughters instead. And this only further enrages the mob, who are then struck blind by the angelic guests. Finding only Lot and his family to be righteous among the inhabitants of the two cities, even though I'm not sure you can call being willing to hand over your daughters to a mob to be righteous, nevertheless, the angel warns Lot to quickly evacuate the city and, here's the kicker, not to look back. As they flee the destruction, you know the story, Lot's wife looks back upon the city and is turned into a pillar of salt. And we don't even know what her name was. We know what Abraham's wife's name was. We know the names of almost all the wives of the patriarchs: Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David. So it's not that Lot's wife couldn't have been given a name in Genesis. Her name is omitted because she has no honor. Her example is significant for her unfaithfulness, not for her accomplishments or her personality. Thus, she loses her worth and she becomes a nameless nobody. We'll get back to Lot's anonymous wife in a moment. First, I should point out the exact nature of the damning wickedness of the cities that have been the subject of much debate recently. As previously mentioned, the mob of men who had accosted the angels had demanded of Lot, this is in Genesis 19:5, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we may know them." This has long been interpreted as carnal knowledge. And many believe that it is the widespread homosexuality of the inhabitants that earns their obliteration. However, modern scholarship, particularly in Judaism and some branches of Christianity, have proposed that it is the inhabitants' lack of hospitality, not their homosexuality, that gives offense to God. Now, I am well aware of how wild and crazy that sounds. We even use the term sodomy to refer to what was taking place in Sodom. It's just so automatic in our thinking. But a lack of hospitality may seem rather tame as a sinful act and hardly worthy of death. But you and I and the majority of historical Christianity may actually be wrong. According to this view, the mob's demand to have relations with the angelic guests revealed their deep-seated violence and inhospitality, and it's meant to stand in stark contrast to the gracious hospitality offered to these same two individuals by Abraham and Lot. Both Abraham and Lot graciously welcomed and fed the strangers. Abraham with a choice calf specially prepared, which was a very big deal, and Lot with a feast and an invitation to rest in his home for the night. From a later period in Israel's history, notice how Ezekiel 16 criticizes the inhabitants of Jerusalem for failing to care for the poor among them, despite their own prosperity. Ezekiel 16:46-49. Ezekiel the prophet says to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, "Your older sister was Samaria, who lived to the north of you with her daughters, and your younger sister who lived to the south of you with her daughters was Sodom. You not only followed their ways and copied their detestable practices, but in all your ways you soon became more depraved than they." More depraved than Sodom. Doing exactly what? "As surely as I live, declares the Sovereign Lord, your sister Sodom and her daughters, her descendants, never did what you and your daughters have done." So Ezekiel is saying to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, your practices are like Sodom, but even worse. Now, this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her citizens practiced homosexuality. Nope, doesn't say that. It says she and her citizens were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and the needy. Wait a minute. This was the sin of Sodom? To show inhospitality, to fail to care for the needs of others? According to the Encyclopedia Britannica, Lot's wife was a disobedient woman who was turned into a pillar of salt for looking back to see the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah as she and her family were fleeing. It says her story is seen as an example of what happens to those who choose a worldly life over salvation. But that's a very modern interpretation. At that time, salvation was not a concept familiar to Abraham and his descendants. God had condemned the cities for their unrighteousness, in particular their hedonism, their selfishness, their coldness to strangers, their base animalistic behavior, all exemplified by their disregard for the needs of the poor, the needy, and the strangers. In ancient Middle Eastern societies, citizens had a moral, ethical, and religious duty to care for strangers, to protect them, to befriend them, to share whatever they had with them. And to fail to do this was sufficient to incur the wrath and punishment of God. The fact that the offense was by men towards others who appeared as men but were in fact angels is secondary, since Lot's daughters were a possible substitute for their ravenous immorality. Whether you prefer to believe that it was homosexuality, inhospitality, or general depravity that doomed Sodom and Gomorrah, clearly there's more going on in this story than it appears on the surface. It's not simply about the acts of the mob towards the men. So, what's with the story of Lot's wife being turned into a pillar of salt? Was she punished for her lack of hospitality? Was she transformed into salt because she was rebellious or failed to follow her husband obediently? Did she just look back because she was sad for her friends, an innocent act that anyone would likely want to do? Remember, this is a moralistic story. So what's the moral? What is the point that the author is trying to get across here? People can't die by turning into salt. That's never happened outside of this story. Some people say that she might have become covered in sulfur. Maybe that's what it was, and it just looked like salt from some volcanic activity that was destroying the cities. But that's not salt, which is sodium chloride. Others suggest that maybe she died of a heart attack and was sort of like frozen in place, like a statue that looked like it had been made of salt. And of course, there's always going to be the conversation-ending assertion that since God can do anything, then there's absolutely no reason to question whether Lot's wife literally became composed no longer of flesh, bone, and blood, but of actual sodium chloride. Let's just consider a little chemistry. And of course, again, you can say God can do anything, so this wasn't a difficult thing for God to do, but why would God do this? And is there a lesson that is getting across to us using this as a type of metaphor? Salt is a compound formed by the neutralization of hydrochloric acid and sodium hydroxide, which is the alkali. A typical salt crop takes 4 to 5 months to make. And if Lot's wife became salt, what happened to her body in an instant? Did it disappear? Was it still there covered by salt? I know you probably never thought of these kind of questions and might wonder why I have so much time on my hands to wonder exactly what did Lot's wife look like, and what was she now made of? But I think these are good ways to read the scriptures. And if it starts to get ridiculous and silly, then that's where you back up and say, there's something else going on here. Where did the hydrochloric acid and the sodium hydroxide come from? Did it just materialize? Of course, none of these explanations are needed. We don't have to go there. We don't have to wonder those things. It's a cautionary tale with an extreme and severe warning at the end. And the message of the tale is perhaps best stated not in the First Testament, but in the Second, in the writings of Paul in Colossians 3:2. This is really what was happening with Lot's wife. It says in Colossians 3:2, therefore, since you have been raised with Christ, strive for the things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God, and set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. That's the lesson of Lot's wife. And again, it is the Apostle Paul who gives voice to the struggle between the flesh and the spirit, and what the spirit attempts to draw us towards. In Romans 8, verses 5 to 8, this is a fairly familiar passage. Paul says, those who live according to the flesh have their minds set on what the flesh desires, like Lot's wife. She desired what she had left behind. But those who live in accordance with the Spirit have their minds set on what the Spirit desires, on what God was calling Lot and his family out to. The mind governed by the flesh is death, and in Lot's wife, it was physical death. But the mind governed by the Spirit is life and peace and freedom. The mind governed by the flesh is actually, says Paul, hostile to God. It does not submit to God's law, nor can it. And those who are in the realm of the flesh, as was Lot's wife, cannot please God. And so in this dramatic story, she's turned into salt. And we'll look at why it was salt in a moment. Lot's wife is classically presented as one whose mind was entrenched in the realm of the flesh. She had obeyed the instructions to leave Sodom, but her flesh craved to return. It wasn't just her material home and her possessions back there. It was her heart's home. Her heart never left. Her heart longed to go back. Now, before we get too critical of Lot's wife, Lot himself was equally at home in Sodom. He too should have been made a pillar of salt. He too was barely more righteous than the rest of the citizens. Genesis 19:16 tells us that the angelic messenger urged Lot to leave Sodom, and at first he didn't. God is going to destroy the city, they told Lot. Hurry and get out of this place. But by dawn the next day, both Lot and his wife are still there. When Lot continued to stall, the angels appeared as men, grasped Lot's hand and the hands of his wife and two daughters, and dragged them out of Sodom to safety. Amen. But just as Eve was the scapegoat for Adam's weakness, so too Lot's wife is a symbol of an unfaithful heart. Thus, Lot must represent righteousness, even if it is a very tenuous and shaky sort of righteousness, in contrast to his wife. So what were the ancient Israelites, the descendants of Abraham, supposed to learn from this? It's a very simple, profound message. This is all about absolute loyalty, complete faithfulness, and unquestioning submission to the one true God. God cannot, and we see this over and over again in all of these purity issues, God cannot coexist with sin and sinners. And as we saw with Noah and the Tower of Babel, God will not tolerate the sin of unrighteousness and rejection of him as Lord and Master. And the most glaring representation of unrighteousness is to fail to love your neighbor as yourself. So Lot's wife obediently complies to leave the city with the male figured Yahweh, the male angelic messengers, and her male husband by leaving Sodom. But in her heart, she longs to belong to her own female voice, back to the depravity expressed as violence towards strangers, represented as unrighteousness. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, the symbolism of salt is simple and effective. Salt destroys impurity. It preserves what is good and prevents that which causes sickness and decay from growing. The cautionary tale of Lot and his wife leaves us with two primary lessons. God is righteous completely, totally, and fully, and righteousness cannot coexist with unrighteousness. And secondly, righteousness must go deeper than following rules and doing what you're told. It must transform the heart. God here in ancient Israel is building a nation of people who serve him from the depths of their being, completely, willingly, and without reservation. And while they and we live in the flesh, that flesh must always be under the rulership and control of the Spirit, which guides us always back to God.